From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Tar Heels Pinole.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
The Yachttown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, what lengths would you go to protect turkeys living in our city streets?
At one time, I had over 40, probably 45, 46.
Then we'll hear exactly how the turkeys destined for our dinner table get there.
We're probably one of the largest in the United States for turkey processing. We can do 28 to 30,000 birds a day.
And we'll hear stories of recent immigrants celebrating their first Thanksgiving.
We understood it as sun-given. So we figure out, oh, it must be some patron saint of the United States.
Giving thanks today on Cross Currents. We're going to start off today's show talking about turkeys. Not the ones you're probably going to eat this evening, but the ones you might run into, say, crossing under a Berkeley overpass. The turkey population is growing throughout California, especially in the East Bay. KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma and Ted Muldoon explored how some Bay Area residents are going above and beyond to protect wildlife from the consequences of city living.
I am currently at the Mountain View Cemetery. It's about 7:23 in the morning, and I'm looking at a gang of turkeys, about 19 large. I'm going to go see if I can get some audio of them.
That's Ted. He's in the Mountain View Cemetery north of Oakland. Granite gravestones and mausoleums dot the sloping landscape. Just for the record, gang is the technical term for a group of turkeys. And what Ted's seeing is becoming increasingly common.
Approaching the turkeys, and they're running. Quick buggers. Our pursuit is leading downhill. I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Wild turkeys now inhabit at least 18% of the state of California. People are also growing in number in the East Bay. In 2013, Alameda was the second fastest growing county in the state. And if both trends continue, cohabitation will inevitably become a challenging proposition. This brings Ted and me to the Lindsay Wildlife Rehabilitation Hospital in Walnut Creek.
In the last season alone, the hospital took in 5,700 animals, injured or orphaned ones from the surrounding area. This season, they've received unusually high numbers of turkeys.
The director of veterinary services at the hospital is Dr. Gertham Purden. He says, over the past two decades, turkeys have adapted a little too well to living amongst people.
Anywhere where it's a little bit woody, a little bit trees, we're getting turkeys now.
The hospital takes in turkeys in varying physical condition. Chicks, for instance.
Also called poults.
Usually are in pretty good health and have just been separated from their parents. They've fallen into a storm drain or gotten cut off from their mothers by a road.
While adult males and females,
called toms and hens,
tend to come in with some pretty grievous injuries. They may be hit by cars. They may have been shot by gun or by arrow.
When they're not being shot at, for the most part, turkeys don't bother people.
But those relationships can grow more complicated when a steady food source is introduced into the mix.
Turkeys will eat pretty much any kind of food. Cat food, dog food that people like to leave out.
Which people do?
You've got these really striking animals that are just moving through your yard, and they look a little bit like dinosaurs, and they're really kind of cool when you think about it. And there's a tendency to want to reach out and kind of participate in that life, in that wildlife.
In a hospital, keeping that distinction between wild and domestic is difficult. But Dr. Purden has helped maintaining that balance.
My name is Deborah Majora, and I'm a volunteer with the Lindsay Wildlife Rehabilitation Hospital.
She's one of many home care volunteers at the hospital.
Turkeys are her specialty.
There was one recently, I'm going to call him Mr. Panhandler. He was at a local retail mall in front of a bank, and I guess he was there maybe 2 months. The customers would come and offer him muffins and things, and he was quite obese. So that's a problem, because if they're obese and they can't fly, then the predators get them, and we've unbalanced the relationship.
Majora's been caring after turkeys in her own home for 4 years now.
The wildlife hospital isn't big enough to house all of the animals they receive.
So volunteers are trained to take care of recovering animals in their own homes. One volunteer looks after all the raccoons.
While another looks after all the foxes.
And another all the hawks.
And so on and so forth.
Only skunks are excluded from this home care system. And not even because of their smell, but because they're a major rabies vector.
Which means they get a lot of rabies.
And actually, Majora ends up taking care of more than just turkeys.
I'm also a member of the possum team and the squirrel team.
The squirrel team.
Majora not only has to look after these animals, she also has to do it while keeping them wild.
Which is easier said than done.
I do not interact with the wildlife like I do with my pets. So I don't carry them around and I don't imprint them on me. The cages are covered in towels and I'm some evil demon that picks them up, cleans them, weighs them, and then puts them back. The bigger ones are big enough they can challenge me, so I tend to turn my back on them, which is why sometimes I get kicked, but that's okay.
How often do you get kicked?
Once a month, maybe. It's okay. It's a good thing.
Lately, Majora's received a lot of turkeys.
This year I had so many that I stopped keeping track because I was just taking care of turkeys. I had more turkeys this year than all prior 3 years combined. At one time I had over 40, probably 45, 46.
Of course, she can't take care of these birds forever. So once a turkey has been fully rehabilitated, Majora takes steps to release it back into the wild.
But the process can be complicated, both legally and logistically. Fish and Wildlife regulations stipulate that turkeys must be returned within 3 miles of where they were originally found. So Majora takes occasional field trips.
We're riding in her SUV in silence. 2 birds sit in the back. They're packed into dog kennels covered in floral sheets. Majora leans over and whispers to me.
Right now they're listening to my voice, but they've never heard it before this, which is not a bad thing, because I don't want them associating people as a good thing.
Majora is driving along the border of Alameda County and Contra Costa County, near the city of Livermore.
We pass large-scale condo developments that all seem to end in the word ranch. These are offset by green hills, where we're headed.
Up until about 10 years ago, this was nothing but rolling hills and homesteads. And all the development you see has occurred just in the last 10 years.
Farther into the hills near a horse stable, we round a corner and come across an unexpected welcoming committee.
Oh, look. We could do it right here. There's your turkeys.
Huddled in front of the car is a gang of 30 turkeys.
That's not the flock I wanted, but we're within the zone. So this works. And they have birds the size I'm bringing, so this is just fine.
As we get out of the car, I raise a concern.
Now, it says no trespassing private property.
But I'm not going to go on the property. The birds fly.
Majora gobbles at the turkeys to attract their attention.
Majora's not big, but she carries a 12-pound turkey the way most people carry a grocery bag. She hoists the kennel on top of the fence and struggles to open the door. The turkey inside bangs against the cage with its chest.
Majora raises the latch.
And the tom takes off like a bat out of hell. The other turkeys sprint after it, like the bird released was their long-lost brother.
Majora looks pleased.
The bird I released is giving a call that says, I'm alone. That's that dee-kee-kee-kee that you hear. And the other birds are calling, come back. That's what I interpret it as. If the bird comes to me, I have failed, and I have never had that happen.
Her plan has got off without a hitch. Majora's done this countless times. But that doesn't mean her solution is the only way to deal with the increasing domestication of wild turkeys.
In cases where turkeys become a nuisance, Fish and Wildlife issue what is known as a depredation permit.
Which means you can kill them.
But these permits are only issued when turkeys cause property damage.
For the rest of us, there are more basic ways to manage turkey populations. Fish and Wildlife suggests installing motion-sensitive sprinklers, removing bird feeders, owning a dog. They even suggest arming oneself with an open umbrella when faced with an aggressive turkey. And there's something else that might keep wild turkeys and humans from bothering each other.
Stop feeding them your cat food.
In Alameda County, this is Hannah Kinzima.
And Ted Muldoon for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Back in 2012, Americans ate 46 million turkeys. But most of us don't really know what the life and death of a turkey entails, or what goes into making them supermarket ready. Radio producer Scott Carrier and the series Hearing Voices sought out to make the process a little more transparent, and a warning to our listeners. This story we're about to hear contains graphic descriptions of a slaughterhouse and may not be suitable for everybody.
In the mountains of central Utah, there's a small town called Moroni. Moroni is the home base of the Moroni Feed Company, a modern farming cooperative of 140 growers and about 2.5 million turkeys. In the summer, in dry weather, the turkeys kick up dust that hangs over Moroni like a smog cloud. They're busy then, eating and gaining weight. Turkeys are good at that. They can grow from the egg to 45 pounds in just 27 weeks. Now, in the fall, the ground is cold and wet, and the turkeys stand around huddled into huge white clouds, 20,000 here, 30,000 across the road. Each turkey looks the same, like a small white ostrich with a bright red wattle and sky blue stain around its eyes. Every eye holds the same bewildered look, the kind of look that says, "What was I saying? What was I saying?"
It's said that a small turkey is so stupid that if he puts his head in a water trough, sometimes they'll forget to take it out and drown themselves.
That's Ken Christensen. He's 21 and runs his family's turkey farm.
And we have others that we have ventilation fans in our coops, and they will, if you don't keep those fans covered, they will fly up to see what the fan is and fly right into it and kill themselves that way. Quite often when we get storms and things like that that come real suddenly down through the valley, they'll begin to climb on one another, especially if they're just new. They're just young turkeys. They'll get out in the middle of a big field and just begin jumping on top of each other, and all the ones on the bottom will get killed eventually because they just keep jumping. So you have to keep them under a shed. And when they're young, you have to make sure they get under the shed when it starts raining or anything like that, because a lot of times they'll just stay out under in the weather and kill themselves. There are a lot of different ways. Turkeys are suicidal by nature, I believe. It's just the way they are. And they're not terribly smart. But
how do you butcher them?
We are not in charge of the butchering. We just grow the turkeys, and the processing plant, which is owned by the cooperative, comes by, and we load them up in trucks. We herd them onto trucks, and then they take them there and then unload them. There they're given a shock and treated.
We're probably one of the largest in the world, in the United States, facility-wise, for turkey processing.
That's Linda Clothier. She's the personnel director for the Moroni Feed Company's processing plant.
We can do 28,000 to 30,000 birds a day.
What's going on inside now?
Okay, this is the hanging area where the trucks come in with the birds live, and they live hang them and kill them. And these men that you see here are live hanging them out of the trucks onto the shackles. These turkeys will come around the shackles, around to the kill area, which is over here, where we have the killers, and they stand there and cut the jugular vein. These are the killers right here. They figure it costs about $20,000 to train a new killer.
Just because of his mistakes.
Yeah. That's the only way to teach him, is to put him there and let him, you know, do it.
What is it that they know how to do so well?
Just the way they cut, the angle they cut on, and how they hold the neck. Make sure that they get that jugular vein. Come in from the blood room, they go into the scalder of hot water, and that loosens up the feathers, and they go through about 5 or 6 picking machines, which literally, they have rubber fingers on them, and it literally beats the feathers off the birds. And the last thing they do in there is they cut off the feet.
Then they come into this, the eviscerating department. They're vacuuming the lungs out of the chest cavity. That's pulling the heads off. Okay, this is the Rotomatic, and it vacuums the air out of the bags and clips them off with a metal clip. And these people are putting the net on and the little white sticker. They put a handle in it.
Period. 60 years ago, I probably would have had to kill my own turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. Now I can buy a Moroni Feed Company turkey here at Dan's Food Town in Salt Lake City. They're sealed in plastic and stacked like cannonballs along the meat counter. All I have to do is take one home, stick it in the oven, and wait until the red thermometer pops up. It's so easy. It's really easy. It's so easy.
That was independent radio producer Scott Carrier. You can hear more of his stories on his podcast, Home of the Brave. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. And now we're going to shift gears from talking about what's on the Thanksgiving table talking about the people gathered around it. For residents who have just moved to the U.S., Thanksgiving can present an entirely new set of traditions. In this StoryCorps interview, Jose Fernandez describes his very first Thanksgiving to his wife, Teresita.
I didn't know about Thanksgiving. From the little English that we knew, my brother and I knew that we were not going to have class that day, and everybody were saying Thanksgiving, but we understood it as sun-given. So we figure out, oh, it must be some patron saint of the United States. And my brother said, well, this must be a real important saint because they're going to have these dinners and so on. So we went over and looked at a missal in Spanish. And we kept looking and we didn't see any saints marked for that particular day. So we asked our friend Jack Johnson, who was our neighbor, great guy, and he explained to my dad, who spoke English, this idea of Thanksgiving. My dad said that Jack had told him that they celebrated with pumpkin pie. So we went out and we got this pumpkin pie, and it was frozen. And we had the sharpest knife there trying to cut it, and we couldn't cut it. And finally we did it. My dad had a piece and I had a piece. And we thought it was just horrible. The next day, we talked to Jack Johnson, and Jack says, no, you're supposed to put the pie in the oven, you know, and bake it. And from then on, I mean, pumpkin pie is a favorite of mine at Thanksgiving.
You after know it's cooked.
Yeah, because it's cooked.
Those were the voices of Jose and Teresita Fernandez speaking as part of StoryCorps. And StoryCorps has an assignment for you, as you may be gathering with multiple generations this Thanksgiving. Document the stories and voices of a grandparent or elder. The project is called the Great Thanksgiving Listen, and StoryCorps encourages you to record interviews using the StoryCorps app over Thanksgiving weekend. The app helps users select questions and record and then upload interviews to the StoryCorps archive in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. You can find a link and learn how to do it at kalw.org. Like Jose Fernandez, author Andrew Lamb has distinct memories of his first Thanksgiving in the U.S. Lamb came to this country as a teenage refugee fleeing the Vietnam War. He shared this story in 2003.
Thanksgiving, said Mr. K, my seventh grade English teacher. Repeat after me, Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, I repeated, but the word tumbled and hissed, turning my mouth into a wind tunnel. A funny word, Thanksgiving, hard on my Vietnamese tongue, tough on my refugee's ears. That's good, said Mr. K, full of encouragement. Very good. Thanksgiving. As I helped him tape students' drawings of turkeys and pilgrims and Indians on the classroom windows, Mr. K patiently explained to me the origins of the holiday. You know the story. Newcomers to America struggling, surviving, and finally thriving in the new world, thanks to the kindness of the natives. I could barely speak a complete sentence in English, having spent less than 3 months in America, but Mr. K's story wasn't all that difficult to grasp. Still, I didn't particularly see what this holiday could have to do with me. My family and I had arrived in America several months earlier at the end of the Vietnam War. My father, a high-ranking officer in the South Vietnamese Army, was missing, having adamantly refused to join us when we fled in the C-130 cargo plane heading out of Saigon 2 days before communist tanks rolled in. Father, who had stayed in Vietnam, determined to fight to the end in the jungle, was the center of our lives, and his absence left a horrible void. We had arrived in America with nothing but rags in our backpacks and a few ounces of gold that my mother had tucked into her money belt. An impoverished aunt took us all in. Soon, there were 10 people crowding together in Auntie Lisa's tiny two-bedroom apartment at the end of Mission Street in San Francisco. Today, in her suburban home at the edge of California's Silicon Valley, my mother is fond of referring to our first year in America as a time of living like wandering ghosts. We had, after all, gone from being an elite family in Saigon with 3 servants and a villa to being exiles with little to our name. We did not speak English and had no discernible skills. With our father, who was educated and spoke English, we were destined for a life of poverty. Thus, in the refugee's home, there was an oppressive silence that hung as heavy as the monsoon rain. We ate in silence in the dining room that served as a bedroom at night. We waited silently in line for the bathroom, slept silently side by side, as if saying anything would only bring us all to tears. Indeed, Mr. K, what was there to be thankful for? Ah, but there was. A few days after Mr. K explained Thanksgiving to me, something marvelous happened. My father called. He had survived and would soon join us, having changed his mind and escaped aboard a crowded naval ship. When father arrived, he was skinny and haggard, no longer the war hero of my memories, but he nevertheless brought jubilation into our lives. I remember hearing my mother laugh, hearing the adult gossip and argue, and sometimes I would close my eyes, pretending that we were all still living in Saigon. One morning, I looked in the mirror and was surprised to see a boy's face smiling back at me. As the holiday drew near, I had a change of heart about Thanksgiving. If Vietnam's final act of mercy was to release its grip on my father, America was generosity itself. As in Mr. K's story, it was populated by friendly natives who helped us out. There was that businessman at the LA airport, a stranger who offered to pay for my entire family's plane tickets to San Francisco when we left the refugee camp. In school, my friends, Remigio, Ty, Marvin, Wayne, Robert, white, black, Filipino, Samoan, Mexican kids, all adopted me. Eric taught me baseball. Ty protected me from the rowdy kids, and Robert, the popular blue-eyed jock, offered to take me on vacation with his family. And best of all, Mr. K, ever patient and nurturing, made me his pet. Whenever I missed the bus or even simply asked, he would drive me home after school. That Thanksgiving, my family gathered on the floor and ate 2 gigantic turkeys donated by a religious charity. The kids fought over the food, and the adults talked about job prospects. There was even talk of a possible trip next summer to the place I equated with paradise, Disneyland. Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving. We have moved into the middle class since then. My father recently retired from his job as a bank executive. My mother from hers as an accountant. Thanksgiving at my parents' home is replete with wines and turkeys and hams and fabulous Vietnamese dishes. But the Thanksgiving I remember best is the first one, where we ate on the floor and wore donated clothes. And I was just learning to pronounce the word.
That was writer and commentator Andrew Lamb talking about his first Thanksgiving in the U.S. That story was produced by Holly Kernan. Andrew Lamb's latest book is Birds of Paradise Lost. Find out more at our website, kalw.org. If you've got ideas for where we should record next, tell us at news@kalw.org. Because of you, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Shireen Adel, Hanna Baba, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. Line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffner.